May is Fibromyalgia Awareness Month. It's important to raise awareness about this chronic and often debilitating invisible illness known as fibromyalgia. This month-long campaign is an opportunity to educate people about the symptoms, causes, and treatments of fibromyalgia, as well as to show support for those living with these and other related invisible illnesses. Through increased awareness, we can work towards better understanding and management of fibromyalgia and ultimately improve the quality of life for those who are affected by it. And now on to this week's episode. Chronic pain is often undertreated, underrecognized, and neglected in many young people, which can lead to long-term consequences later in life. While the causes of chronic pain are multifactorial, there has been increased awareness that chronic pain arises from pathologic mechanisms related to how the central nervous system interprets and modulates sensory information, known as nociplastic pain. It's possible that this pathophysiology is initiated early in life, as many adult chronic pain patients report first experiencing pain in childhood. All of this raises a critical question for pain management, and the researchers asked the question, are we missing a critical window in childhood where the lifelong course of chronic pain could be altered or even arrested? If this is your first episode, thanks for joining us. I am your host, Dr. Michael Lenz. I am a pediatrician and internist, a lifestyle medicine physician, and a clinical lipidologist. I'm also author of the book, Conquering Your Fibromyalgia. The goal of this podcast is to inform, inspire, and equip those who are struggling with fibromyalgia and other chronic overlapping pain conditions to go beyond just learning to live with, but to living better and even at times reversing your fibromyalgia. Remember that while I am a doctor, I am not your doctor. All of your signs and symptoms should be discussed with your own individual physician. And now on to this week's episode. For many adults living with chronic pain, they've had it for decades, sometimes going on 70 years if they've had it since childhood and they're in their 70s and beyond. For many clinicians caring for patients who have chronic pain, the longer and more severe someone's chronic pain has been, the more challenging it is for them to get better. And for many experts like Dr. Daniel Claw, that early recognition is so key to get on top of this. And that's why when I take care of families who have chronic pain, as this strongly runs in families, it is very rewarding. It's often the relief and grief, the relief that a mom or dad is getting help, and the grief is how many decades they had to suffer. Yet there also is a relief that when their child is coming in with chronic pain, the recognition and education and treatment of coexisting comorbid conditions is available, and now the cycle does not have to be repeated in their children. How common is chronic pain in children? Well, 1 in 4 will have chronic pain, and the majority of these children will experience chronic pain in adulthood. In children, headache, abdominal pain, and musculoskeletal pain are among the most commonly reported conditions. This means that in a pediatric office, 1 in 4 patients have some form of chronic pain condition. If you're a pediatrician listening, or family practice doctor who sees a lot of children, 1 in 4 of your pediatric patients has a chronic pain condition. Maybe chronic headaches, chronic stomach pain, maybe migraines, painful periods, maybe pain in multiple areas of your body. Sadly, most of us pediatricians have received very little education on recognition, diagnosis, and management of chronic pain. When a child experiences pain in multiple sites, for example, headache and musculoskeletal pain without any peripheral signs of injury, it is likely that there is nociplastic pain involvement.
An adult's functional MRI has demonstrated that these nociplastic pain conditions exist and are characterized by having ascending pain signals and a failure of the descending pain inhibition and enhanced integration of sensory, default mode, and effective brain networks. The few studies examining the central nervous system alterations in children with this nociceptive or centralized pain also indicate increased nociceptive activity and decreased descending inhibition. However, there are essentially no data addressing whether these changes precede, correlate with, or are consequences of chronic pain. Further, while some studies have addressed central nervous system predictors of pain persistence, in these cases, all of the participants had acute pain at baseline. Examining the neurobiological underpinnings of the natural history of pain in children has the potential to identify critical vulnerabilities and targets for prevention and early treatment.
It's recognized that early identification and treatment of those who are at risk for atherosclerosis, which leads to heart attacks and strokes, is key. If you wait until later in life, it's not that you can't prevent problems, but often there is an accumulation of a lot of plaque. It's much harder to reverse all of the plaque if it's been there for many decades. However, if we start early with early recognition and then appropriate treatment, heart attacks essentially should be preventable unless somebody has an iatrogenic cause such as cocaine where there's a severe spasm of the artery.
The Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study is the largest prospective longitudinal study of brain development and child health in the United States and thus provides an unprecedented opportunity to examine whether differences in neural activity frequently reported in adults with chronic pain also exist in children before the onset of pain. In the study, they examined a group of children from the two assessments of the ABCD study who were pain-free at baseline and then exhibit new multi-site pain 1 year later. They chose to use new multi-site pain as the outcome of interest because multi-site pain is more likely to reflect a vulnerability mediated by aberrations in central nervous system processing of pain rather than a transient peripheral injury or pain restricted to one body area. They hypothesized that children who develop multi-site pain would have increased activity and functional connectivity within brain regions associated with pain processing, specifically the insula, primary somatosensory cortex, and the anterior cingulate at a baseline relative to matched controls. They also hypothesized that children who develop pain would have decreased functional connectivity in the periaqueductal gray, a key anti-nociceptive brain region. In exploratory analyses, they examined if structural changes were also present before the onset of multi-site pain.
The presence of pain was captured in the child behavior checklist, which was completed by their parents about their child at baseline and the one-year assessment. Parents were asked if the child currently or within the last 6 months suffered from the following physical problems without any known medical cause. These included aches or pains, headaches, and stomach aches. The responses were categorized as not true, somewhat true, and very true. Their definition of multi-site pain was at least two of the three pain items in the last year that were either sometimes or often when no pain was reported at baseline. Matched controls did not have pain at either point and were matched to new multi-site pain cases based on their sex, puberty status, by their race or ethnicity, and handedness. Functional MRI data were obtained and then processed. They were able to look at different areas of the brain. The testing looks at blood oxygen level dependent signals. The acronym for that is BOLD. This is a common method for identifying areas of the brain that are more active than others. The brain uses 20% of our body's oxygen demands and different parts of the brain that'll be more active than others. I won't dive into the granular details of the data processing, but you can look those up if you are interested by pulling up the study online. What were the results? The authors note that to their knowledge, this was the first study to report that altered brain signatures precede the development of new multi-site pain in children who were pain-free at baseline. They found that increased activity in the sensory motor regions and increased functional connectivity between the insula, sensory motor, and default mode network regions predicted new onset multi-site pain 1 year later. Many results in this study are consistent with those observed in adults with chronic nociplastic pain conditions, which are characterized by widespread pain, as well as the pain vulnerable brain networks, as hypothesized earlier in a study by Dink to set the stage for abnormal pain processing later in life. In their paper, Pain Vulnerability, A Neurobiological Perspective, they wrote that what everyone can agree on is that a sizable degree of risk is indeed accounted for by genetics. Most heritability estimates from twin studies range from 13 to 60% depending on the pain phenotype and cohort examined. And heritability can reach 30% for severe chronic pain even in the general population. This has been conducted through case control candidate gene association studies that have revealed a wide variety of risk alleles. They have identified involvement of neurotransmitter systems as well as ion channel function and immune function. For most of these mechanistic steps by which any single nucleotide polymorphism or haplotype identified might confer risk towards chronic pain in later life are not very clear, although more functional and preclinical studies are beginning to emerge. There are limits on these genetic studies for a variety of reasons. A fundamental question that remains and the answer to which will greatly influence study design is whether many genes are linked to nociception and pain. In their theory, risk for chronic pain is a combination of three general categories: hardware at birth, which includes your sex, your genotype, and your epigenetic profile. In other words, if your mom was diabetic while you were pregnant, you had no control over that, but those epigenetic factors can turn on and off genes. Environmental influences is a second category. These are acute injury or disease at critical developmental periods, stressful life events, which can be mechanical or emotional stress, and the gene and environment interactions. Somebody's call it personality, psychology. You may say somebody is autistic or has ADHD. And under these are the innate mechanisms, acquired mechanisms, or priming, as you might call it, and then brain vulnerable networks was theorized. Their conclusions in the study was that the research left little doubt that certain groups of people are more vulnerable to develop chronic pain conditions. Evidence and viable hypotheses can be found as to why genetics and adverse priming events, such as a prior or stressful environmental influences, may confer increased risk. They hypothesized that the characterization of brain imaging signatures in pain-free individuals before any injury will be crucial if they are able to identify the relevant vulnerable networks. They shared that the desire to identify and understand the biological underpinning of risk factors is often motivated by the hope for more targeted or preventive treatments. Indeed, in the case of chronic pain, it may be possible to use a combination of brain-related measures, quantitative sensory testing, and genotyping to aid stratification and improve treatment selection and targeting of interventions. They predicted that a future study, like the one we are reviewing today, would identify that there was a difference in how the brain processes pain. They thought that with this research, they could have targeted therapy. Many of you listening, struggling with pain, or have children who are struggling with chronic pain, or their child has not reported any symptoms, but they are wondering if their child is at risk for developing chronic pain. Well, we know that if you yourself has chronic pain, one of these conditions, they are at increased risk.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I want to briefly interrupt the podcast to inform you about the Fibromyalgia Starter Pack, which is now available. If you are new to this podcast, it categorizes the episodes in a way that it's more beneficial for those new to fibromyalgia. You can access the link in the show notes to learn more.
Also, if your spouse has a chronic pain, the risk goes up even more. However, functional MRI testing is very expensive, and it's not specific enough that you could clearly identify that you have a predisposition on an individual level. The study involved many individuals. You are looking for the difference between two populations. So when you look at the graphs, there are overlapping areas where a person or a child who has not had pain may overlap into the same area as a child who has had pain. This makes me think of a clinic in the Chicago area called the Amen Clinic, where they use functional MRIs to diagnose ADHD. Functional MRI is not recommended for making the diagnosis of ADHD. And in the same way, we are not recommending using functional MRIs to make a clinical diagnosis or to predict on an individual level if someone is at risk for developing pain. This study suggests there is a neural connectivity that may precede the development of chronic pain. The insula is a key area of the salient network and an important region for the pain perception and cross-modal sensory integration. The insula plays a critical role in converting salient physiological inputs into higher level cognitive states or emotions and acts as a switch for attentional control by coordinating activity in the task positive and task negative. Those are also called the frontal parietal and the default mode networks of the brain. The default mode networks comprise of the posterior cingulate, the precuneus, the inferior parietal lobule, which includes the angular gyrus, and the lateral temporal cortex, and the medial prefrontal cortex, is active at rest and engaged during self-referential thought. In the healthy participants, the default mode network and the salient network are anti-correlated at rest. In children who develop multi-site pain, they found increased connectivity between the salient network and the angular gyrus and tends towards increased connectivity between the bilateral posterior insula and bilateral angular gyri. These findings are remarkably consistent with neuroimaging in adults with chronic pain that have found increased connectivity between the insula and the default mode network. One major unanswered question in adult studies is whether increased connectivity among the salient networks and the default mode network regions is a cause or consequence of chronic pain. The results in this study provide evidence that such changes precede symptomatic multi-site pain. One hypothesis is the increased insula default mode network functional connectivity may prime an individual to be more sensitive to sensory inputs, an idea consistent with the insula's role in directing attention and adjusting the gain, like the volume control, on incoming stimuli. This hypothesis is further supported by the findings of increased activity in the M1 and S1, or the motor and sensory areas, as we discussed earlier, and a trend towards decrease in the medial prefrontal cortex in children who develop pain. Prefrontal cortex also is the area involved in ADHD. Heightened insula or salient network to the default mode network conductivity in pain-free children may be a subclinical marker of neural vulnerability for developing multi-site pain later in life. It is possible that brain networks have been primed by innate genetic or acquired early life stresses or environmental exposures in children who develop multi-site pain, resulting in brain regions being hyperactive and more strongly connected to each other. Animal models have shown that activity in the insula, amygdala, cingulate, and the S1 area is altered in adult rats that have experienced early life stress. They went on to say that cortical striatal circuitry was not a significant predictor of new onset pain. Previous work has implicated this pathway in the transition from acute to chronic pain in adults. They suspected that children examined here are too early in the stages of pain development to show this alteration, and the involvement of these regions may become apparent at future time points in children whose pain is unresolved. There were no significant baseline differences in the cortical thickness and gray matter volume in children who developed multi-site pain, suggesting that brain changes precede pain onset, but structural changes do not. Rodriguez, Reike, and colleagues hypothesize that gray matter changes are a consequence rather than the cause of chronic pain, which represents neuroplasticity. since they noted that gray matter abnormalities resolved after successful hip replacement surgery in osteoarthritis patients, a finding that has been since replicated in chronic pediatric pain. Of note, they found no sex differences in the neural activity or functional connectivity findings that preceded new multi-site pain. This may initially seem inconsistent with the established sex differences observed in pain sensitivity and the prevalence of many chronic pain conditions, but it is actually consistent with indications that sex differences in chronic pain emerge in mid to late puberty, and the majority of participants in the study were prepubertal or in early puberty, as the age was between 9 and 11 years old. Before puberty, boys and girls have a similar prevalence of chronic pain. However, this prevalence changes dramatically during puberty, as significantly more girls develop chronic pain than boys. This remains largely constant throughout the lifespan, where adult females are about twice as likely to report multi-site pain than males. Puberty, of course, is characterized by hormonal, physical, and behavioral changes that are often sex-specific, and is also a period of substantial neural reorganization and development, particularly in cortical and limbic brain areas. Sex differences in brain function and structure coincide with pubertal development and appear to be mediated by hormones. Sex-specific hormonal changes occurring during puberty may differentially affect pain processing and vulnerability, and therefore it is likely that sex differences in the brain function and pain will emerge as ABC example reaches mid to late puberty. To summarize, they demonstrated that increases in activity and functional connectivity between pain processing brain regions exist before the onset of multi-site pain. Although their findings were based on parental report of their child's pain and should be interpreted with caution, these results may represent the neural underpinnings of pain vulnerability and highlights the need for more research and development origins of pain. Future studies should examine how the brain changes during pain chronification and the moderating impacts of environmental, psychosocial, and genetic factors. If these results are confirmed, they may represent targets for early interventions that prevent pain chronification. What are your thoughts when you hear this study? I find it very interesting. When you look at family histories, even when we were talking about neurasthenia, going back in time, they knew that there was a strong genetic factor. And just in taking family histories with patients, this supports and validates, at a minimum, again, that what you're experiencing is real pain, but how your brain processes stimuli is different. There is different connections and stronger connections in areas of brain that make somebody more vulnerable, but not everybody gets pain. And if you can have the appropriate supports, looking at a multifaceted approach, looking at the role of lifestyle medicine and the role of identifying comorbid health issues and treating those appropriately, all of these have this multi-directional impact on the experience of pain. As always, I'd love to hear your feedback. You can email me at drmichaellenz@gmail.com. Until next week, go Team Fibro.